This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The idea was that top congressional Democrats would meet with President Trump and top Republicans today because, after all, they've all got to work together to avoid a potential government shutdown that could be just 10 days away. That was the idea. But then President Trump tweeted. He wrote, quote, "Meeting with Chuck and Nancy today about keeping government open and working. Problem is, they want illegal immigrants flooding into our country, are weak on crime, and want to substantially raise taxes. I don't see a deal," end quote. So, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer and Representative Nancy Pelosi said, fine, no meeting. Here's Schumer a little while ago on the Senate floor.
"The president said, I don't see a deal, 3 hours before our meeting, before he heard anything we had to say. Given that the president doesn't see a deal between Democrats and the White House, Leader Pelosi and I believe the best path forward is to continue negotiating with our Republican counterparts in Congress instead."
Over at the White House, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told Democrats to, quote, "stop the political grandstanding." But with this morning's tweet, it's the president who dangled the possibility of a government shutdown, something he's explicitly threatened twice before this year. So let's get the view of a member of the Massachusetts delegation. We spoke a little bit earlier with Congressman Richard Neal. I asked him what he thought of the Democrats' decision to pull out of today's meeting with the president.
"Well, I don't understand in this atmosphere, and it's completely foreign to me, how the president believes that you can insult your way to cooperation.
Right.
And I think trying to find common purpose and being invited to the White House really ought to engage sort of a pretty sophisticated and important conversation, given the problems that the nation faces.
But on the other hand, wouldn't it be advantageous to Democrats to rise above that and go ahead and meet anyway? Because he still is the president of the United States.
I think the difficulty with that is, and you run the risk of being insulted after the meeting is over, not based upon the substance of the meeting, as opposed to the conflict that was built into the meeting from the beginning by the use of technology.
I feel like we're in an age now that, regardless of party, given the president's use of Twitter, that's just going to happen no matter what. What can Democrats do to deal with the president or to work with him, knowing that no matter what they do, or even for some Republicans, no matter what they do, there's going to be some kind of response on Twitter from the president of the United States?
Well, I think that this conflict has been simmering for a long period of time, and I think that part of the difficulty is the development of what I would refer to as instant opinion. The problem with instant opinion is that frequently you don't draw the right conclusions based on additional evidence. And I would hope that given the debate over taxes, the debate over health care, the debate over what to do about North Korea, that you would actually have people in an adult moment saying that we're not going to do any tweeting, we're simply going to sit down and discuss some of these problems. I think that would be advantageous to the American family.
You know, I'm just looking once again at the president's tweet from several hours ago, and the full text of it is, "meeting with Chuck and Nancy today," and he put those in quotes, "about keeping government open and working. Problem is, they want illegal immigrants flooding into our country unchecked and are weak on crime and want to substantially raise taxes. I don't see a deal." That was what the president wrote on Twitter. I mean, let's just talk about the substance of his accusations about Democrats. What do you make of him saying that Democrats want to raise taxes, showing opposition to the Republican tax plan?
Well, if you, I think, follow the president's tweeting to its manifest moment, and what you're essentially having him say is that he's already made a decision before the negotiations can commence. Now, that's entirely different than what he said just a few months ago when he indicated that there was a path to perhaps finding agreement on the DACA situation and the tax issues. And there are still a number of Medicare extenders that have to be done, and also renewing the Children's Health Insurance Program is important as well. So I don't understand how the use of insult and invective can be helpful to trying to resolve some of these issues as we now come down the home stretch of the legislative calendar.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know that the Senate will eventually vote on its version of changes to the tax code, but I want to talk with you for a second about the one that did pass through the House. I mean, you voted against it, right?
I did.
Yeah. So talk to me about the parts of it that led you to not support it, because, you know, a major thrust of the tax plan is the idea that taxes would get cut for many Americans.
Well, I also think that the key to the discussion over taxes is really a review of distributional tables to have a better understanding of who gets what. And once the budget ceiling was built at $1.5 trillion, which actually when you consider that that's money that's going to be borrowed over 10 years, the borrowing comes closer to $2.3 trillion. But the problem is what we were being asked to give up to secure tax relief for people really at the very top. I don't understand, for example, why there is this necessity to repeal the estate tax. I don't know why there's this necessity to repeal the alternative minimum tax. And the Congressional Budget Office, as recently as this morning, has indicated that by, I believe, 2025, people who earn under $75,000 a year, they're going to be asked to pay for this. I mean, trying to shoehorn these budget numbers into our tax system is the challenge. And I think that, again, there was an opportunity here for both parties in a bipartisan manner, referenced upon what had happened in 1986, where there were committee hearings, 450 witnesses offered testimony, and both parties found accommodation is the path that we should have followed here. And unfortunately, that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. Now, what about the alternative minimum tax? Because I know a couple of years ago, you were part of an effort to eliminate the AMT for middle-class families.
Right. And I've been successful on that front. Yeah. And 27 million Americans, middle-class Americans, no longer pay alternative minimum tax. And I'd like to take full responsibility for that, to be candid with you, because over the course of three presidential administrations, I offered the crusade against middle-class people paying alternative minimum tax. Now you're down to 4.5 million families being asked to pay alternative minimum tax, who in fact are really the upper crust in America. And I think that putting the spotlight on that is very important.
Yeah. Now, just if I could ask you, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the Senate's version of a tax plan.
Oh, I sure do.
Okay, so tell me about it. Because what about the provision in there to repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual insurance mandate?
Well, I think that that's very poor policy in terms of choice. I think that this should be done with full legislative discussion. Recall that in the Senate there were no hearings as well. You're now looking at the end of New Markets tax credits, the historic tax credit. You're going to be boosting taxes on people who take advantage of the health care deduction once you've expended 10% of your income. And again, you're targeting people in an effort to cut the tax rate for people at the very top. And I think that's where the miscalculation is coming in. And right now, of interest, this is when you're seeing the patchwork work being undertaken. This is when there's an effort made in the Senate to accommodate every conceivable effort to get to 52. So you're seeing drilling in the ANWR being added. You're seeing the mandate being added. And now you're going to perhaps see a proposal that will change how pass-through entities are taxed. Mm-hmm. This is all in an effort to get to 52. And it will not be pleasant to watch.
I mean, I don't know. Are you hearing from your Senate colleagues? Do you think they can get there?
Well, I think there's about six individuals who have either stated some agnosticism on tax reform or said that they can't support it in its current form. So I think that there are six what we would call the Democratic side gets for that purpose. And I'm hopeful that if this were to go down, then they would come back to us and say, look, let's do this in a manner that's similar to what took place back in 1986. And I want to tell you, in all sincerity, I'm in for negotiation.
Okay. Well, if we can just pivot slightly for a moment, Congressman, I just want to ask you about, another major issue going on Capitol Hill, that Representative John Conyers is stepping aside as ranking member of the Judiciary Committee because of sexual harassment allegations. And, of course, Senator Al Franken also facing severe sexual harassment allegations. I mean, do you think that there's kind of a crisis on this brewing on Capitol Hill, and what can people do?
Well, I don't know that there's a crisis, but I do think that in both instances, this should be handled by the Ethics Committee, and I think a careful examination by the Ethics Committee would perhaps shed some light on the need to change the law that was passed in 1995. So we would have a better understanding as to the proportion of individuals that might or might not be involved in this. One of the challenges here really is that there is such a thing as due process. And the secondary issue that I think we need to be mindful of is, how do you undo perhaps agreements that have been made with a guarantee of certain privacies? So I think those are legal questions, but as much as we would all like to, I think, have more light to be shown on what happened, you do run into some legal technicalities. So I'm okay with these two cases being referred to ethics.
Really? Okay. Because, I mean, I take your point about legal technicalities and due process. But Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi a couple of days ago said that, you know, part of what needs to happen is that John Conyers needs to do the right thing. And there was some pushback to that because it's not really up to him, right? It's up to the Ethics Committee. I just wonder if this is a moment where Democrats could show some more spine
sure.
on this
yeah,
issue.
Yeah, and I agree. But I think that you perhaps are, not you, but I think perhaps we're having an argument about 1995 in the year 2017, and things have certainly changed pretty radically given the press postings that have, I think, described some pretty bad behavior. So I think that there's an opportunity here to go forward on it. And recall that in the Conyers case in particular, that would be up to the Democratic caucus to decide whether or not he would stay in his position. And I think he wisely decided that he knew what was going to happen, and the outcome was for him to step aside while the Ethics Committee undertakes its work.
Mm. Finally, just a kind of broad-based question, Congressman, because I'm really curious about what every member of the delegation thinks about this. I mean, what is the mood like on Capitol Hill these days? I mean, from here at home, we sort of look over in Washington and see this giant hornet's nest of dysfunction. Is that fair?
I think that certainly the intense polarization has not been helpful, and I think that the well-organized efforts on the left and the right, they have known where just to put the needle in. And I also think that the news media undertakes now what I would consider to be 24 hours of speculation and analysis. And I also think that part of the challenge is that this has really gone on for a long period of time. This isn't something that just happened. I mean, you can go back to the Jim Wright investigation, the Newt Gingrich investigation. You can go to the Tower nomination. You can go to the Thomas nomination. You can go to the Clinton impeachment. You could go to Bush v. Gore. And this has really gone on for a long period of time, and I wish that we would be able to return to the days in which I joined the Congress back in 1988 when you really had civilized conversations and people tried to find common purpose. But the polarization that you currently witness in Congress is not healthy for a representative democracy.
You say you wish. Does that mean that you don't think it's actually possible?
I think Tip O'Neill used to have a great comment when he used to suggest that the people that were in the well of the House yelling every day, they were generally the ones who had political problems back home. And I think that the fact that language is more acerbic and incendiary, only to be desirous of drawing the quote, has also not been helpful.
Well, Congressman Richard Neal, really appreciate this conversation today. All right, take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, we spoke with Congressman Neal earlier today. Now, in just the past half hour, news on that Senate tax bill. The Senate Budget Committee voted 12-11, a party line vote, to send the Republican Senate tax bill to the full floor. They just took that vote this afternoon, and a full Senate vote could take place as early as Thursday. But is every Republican senator on board? Well, just a little while ago, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he's working on it.
It's a challenging exercise. Think of sitting there with a Rubik's Cube trying to get to 50.
All right, let's go to Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about that Senate Budget Committee vote, because two Republican holdouts on the bill, Bob Corker and Ron Johnson, have they dropped their objections because they both voted to advance the bill to the full floor?
They did, and they're not fully dropping their objections. They're using language that President Trump, we're told, was used in this meeting with Republicans today, which is, let's keep the process going. So they did drop at least some of their objections to fixing the legislative text that they wanted to be fixed in committee, and they're moving it to the Senate floor. Ron Johnson, Bob Corker, two of those who were holding out, could still vote against it on the Senate floor, but they are saying with their votes today that we want this process to move forward.
Okay, I'm seeing here, actually, the Washington Post is quoting Bob Corker as saying, "I was able to work out something that is fairly satisfying to me just a few minutes ago, and I plan to vote yes." I think that was on the Budget Committee vote that just took place. What about Susan Collins? Because, again, there's just a handful of senators here who haven't fully committed, GOP senators who haven't committed to the tax bill, and McConnell can only afford to lose one or two of them. But I'm seeing that Susan Collins is saying that today, after meeting with the president, that a lot of her concerns are being addressed.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some momentum for the tax bill right now after this meeting. Heading into this budget committee vote, there was some speculation that it could meet a roadblock, and it didn't. It cleared the roadblocks, at least for now. And you know, the senators are increasingly using language that suggests that they're open to voting for this package. One of the things to watch for is Susan Collins, and again, she's suggesting that she's open to voting for this, but the individual mandate and whether that provision stays in and what that looks like in the final text is something that Susan Collins has expressed some concern with. Sort of how those concerns are being addressed, we don't quite know yet.
Yeah, I'm wondering, have we heard anything from the likes of John McCain or Lisa Murkowski on this yet? Because, of course, they were two of the key votes that no votes that ended up killing the GOP's effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So have we heard anything from them yet about the tax bill?
They are also expressing a little bit of, you know, holding out. You know, they're not sort of fully committing either way. The individual mandate is a little bit different politically for some of those senators than the full-scale repeal of the health care bill. You're seeing Susan Collins, for example, start to talk about how she views it as, you know, more appropriate at not requiring people to buy health care insurance, you know, as opposed to her opposition to repealing the entire Affordable Care Act as the previous health care bill would do. So they're moving more in that direction of trying to justify publicly why they would be okay with getting rid of the individual mandate.
Mm. Now, in my conversation with Congressman Neal a couple of minutes ago, he had mentioned some numbers from the Congressional Budget Office. Just to recap those, the CBO said that it believes that that the Senate tax bill could hurt workers earning less than $30,000 a year, and then that by 2027, the CBO says Americans earning $75,000 a year or less as a group would actually see their taxes increase because the individual tax cuts would expire near the end of 2025. It doesn't seem like any of those numbers are making a big difference in terms of yes and no votes amongst the GOP, Matt.
Not among Republicans, but it's certainly giving Democrats some political ammunition as they argue against this tax bill. And should it pass, going into the midterms, trying to make that case ever more strenuously to voters. So I think that could come in this next phase, and you're hearing a lot of that. And these statistics and the attempts to analyze exactly what this tax bill would do to an average taxpayer, a middle-class taxpayer, you know, certainly those messages are getting out there. But so far, there's been a lot of moving pieces to what this legislation is. And we should also point out that whatever the Senate passes is likely to be quite different from what the House passed. And there will have to reconcile those differences before this can go to President Trump's desk
right.
for any signature. So I think that you're starting to get some of those conversations and full analysis of what this means.
Yeah.
But in general, corporations seem to do a lot better under a lot of these analyses compared to middle class taxpayers.
Right. Well, Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.